Welcome back to our amazing wrestling podcast, which is now rebranded. It is called Wrestling is Everything, Everything is Wrestling. And we're on Twitter now. We got our own Twitter account, WEW Pod, which is Wrestling is Everything is Wrestling Podcast. And it looks like we had some questions come in on Twitter, which we'll answer later, which is amazing. But we're here. We're glad. I'm Brian Kluger. We're with Tom Nix. We're with Mike Pertil. It's like getting the band back together. It's just the original three amigos talking about wrestling. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording this podcast. And if there's ever a chance, like Mike or like Tom said, if there's ever a chance to do a recap episode of past awesome matches from, you know, this past week, this is the week to do it because so much happened. We had NXT TakeOver Brooklyn Part 2. We had SummerSlam. You have Raw. We have SmackDown. And we have Talking Smack. It is so crazy this week. So
And that's just WWE stuff. That's not even counting the Best of the Super Juniors tournament. That's not even counting the Ring of Honor pay-per-view on Friday night. There was two Evolve shows this weekend. It was wrestling crazy town.
Yeah, it was like five or six days of wrestling.
Yeah, and the most wrestling thing of the weekend turned out to not be a wrestling event at all. Conor McGregor and Nate Diaz had a five-round epic that was essentially a reboot of Shawn Michaels versus The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. It was, if I were to script a UFC match, I would script it exactly like McGregor Diaz 2, all the way down to the end, in which they essentially challenged each other to a third fight while they were still in the ring. So, you know, this week, yes, wrestling is everything, but as we've said before, as it turns out, also everything is wrestling.
That's true. So before we get into it, because we're going to get into some of the details here, but I just want from each of you, just in one sentence, Tom, what was the best thing you saw from NXT TakeOver till today as far as wrestling goes? What was the best match or best promo you saw?
Mike the Miz Mizanin laying a firebomb on Daniel Bryan.
Okay, all right, and I asked the same question to Mike Pertil.
The king of strong style, Shinsuke Nakamura, entering the ring with a live violinist and then winning the NXT championship.
Those were all mine, but I have to say my favorite was the Brock Lesnar Randy Orton match, just because of just Brock Lesnar thought it was a actual UFC fight. But we'll get there. Let's go all the
way. He was shooting, brother.
But
let's just start there. So
okay,
if we're talking about, so Brian, what was your takeaway from that match?
So I was really, really excited about this match because they really built it up really well. It's like they really haven't fought before, but they kind of came up together, and it just seemed like Randy Orton's just like the good guy. He was literally just so happy to be back. It's like, I think I can take this guy on. It's going to be hell, but I think I can take Brock on. And Brock was being the literal asshole and just like, he's not going to do anything. He's going to die in the first 5 seconds.
I believe I can die.
I can believe I could touch the sky. So the match started out really well. The match at first, that when Brock just went full UFC and like basically tackled him into the rope, I was like, oh god, you saw Randy Orton's face. He's like, oh, he means business. And there was like real punches. And then Brock let, you know, the UFC out of him fade, and he kind of wrestled. There was a couple RKOs, but he kicked out. And then, for some reason, Brock just went full-on UFC mode and started elbowing Randy Orton in the head. And it, of course, it split him open, and they called the match, which was so unfortunate. But he was losing a lot of blood. And just like Tom said on text message that day, this is not 2004 Eddie Guerrero. They're not going to allow the blood in the ring like that. But that, it was such a violent, hardcore match for me that I was like, oh, these two guys are really going at it, and I just wish it lasted longer. But that was me. But it really was, even though I wish, you know, a title was the main event, this was a great main event because it was just so epic as far as it lasted. What about you guys?
Sometimes I forget that as much as Brian absolutely marks out over Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit matches before Chris Benoit was what he's known for, I keep forgetting that Brian's bread and butter is Singapore death matches.
It's so true. It's so true.
So, I mean, I liked it as a main event because I really expected an actual match out of those two. But initially I thought it was kind of a weird and off-putting way to end their biggest pay-per-view. And also, I don't want to say it made SmackDown look weak, but I mean, like, effectively, SmackDown's biggest star, or one of their biggest stars, was essentially murked by one of Raw's biggest stars. I mean, it wasn't even really close.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't.
So that was a weird booking decision. Plus, it's a weird booking decision for me because had Brock beaten Mark Hunt at UFC and just that's what happened and no controversy, I can 100% see that being the conclusion of every Brock Lesnar match, because who could touch him at that point? But the fact that the whole, doping thing came out, and the fact that he's now suspended from UFC and all that kind of stuff, I really thought that there was a good chance Orton was going to come out on top, or at least it would be a more fair fight. But the fact that they're still doubling down on Brock as an unstoppable monster, despite the fact that the world knows that he dopes, is interesting. But at the same time, like, it got people talking. We talked about it. We're talking about it first on this podcast. I don't think it was a bad decision at all. In hindsight, it was just one of those, like, kind of, oh, that was strange ways to end the pay-per-view. But I tuned into SmackDown more so than Raw because I knew that Brock wasn't going to be on Raw. I really did tune into SmackDown specifically to see how the fallout from that match was going to go, because Shane got involved and Randy got it looked like super hurt. So I was invested on how is Shane going to respond to Brock crossing the line. That even though the match ending didn't set my world on fire, how are they going to get out of this, or what are they going to do with this, was interesting enough for me to actively be in front of my TV Tuesday night to see how Shane would respond.
Yeah, what about you, Mike? Do you agree with all that? Did you like
it? There were two things about it that I really loved in terms of what it did. I mean, obviously, it was jarring and it was off-putting to see just that violent of a finish, and then to have the show just go off the air. It was jarring, and it wasn't as, you know, it's funny to go back to UFC for a second, you know. One of the downsides of ordering a UFC pay-per-view is that the main event could be really truncated and grotesque. And, you know, the upside of ordering a WWE pay-per-view is that you know you're going to get this sort of, you know, the main event's going to at least try to be maximized for dramatic effect. And somehow those two things flipped this weekend. But, you know, I was concerned that Lesnar was going to be diminished by the doping scandal and that he would be, you know, somewhat less valuable to the company going forward. And watching the way that he just completely destroyed Orton to the point that the Chris Jericho Brock Lesnar post SummerSlam fight or true or not, you know, it did have a lot of people wondering whether we were supposed to see what we saw. And it left him coming out of SummerSlam with at least the hint that maybe he's just going rogue and is such a violent human being that he cannot be stopped. Now, I think that was really well-crafted storytelling. I don't think he's a renegade, but that was really exciting to me, the fact that we've sort of rehabilitated Brock Lesnar the monster from what we were saying last week was his lowest point. And then the other thing that was great was I had lunch with a friend on Wednesday who's not a wrestling fan, and he said, tell me about this Lesnar-Orton thing. And that's exactly what having a crossover star like Brock Lesnar should get for you. And I think WWE managed to really make the most of it. It, you know, it's a shame that it required Randy Orton to die. I think that he's an excellent professional wrestler. We're going to talk about Randy Orton more in detail next week. But I think that, you know, ultimately I think it might have been worth it.
Yeah. No, that's something a couple days of distance has improved my perception of it. Because, I mean, there was a lot of, like, boo-boo, that was terrible, what a stupid way to end a pay-per-view, you know, nonsense going on online. But, I mean, no one complains about the thing they love more than wrestling fans. But I think what saved it kind of is what Mike was pointing out. And one of the reasons why we really wanted to call this podcast Wrestling is Everything is Wrestling is because everything is wrestling. The whole Jericho-Brock thing was at least partially a work. Everything that has led up to that match and everything that happened afterward is all part of the story. And there, I feel like there's a lot of, you know, stuff that's just happening, quote-unquote, behind the scenes or being reported on WWE.com or being reported somewhere else that is helping build the storyline. I mean, what better way to get your, you know, smarky internet reading audience invested than hearing that a legendary wrestler was concerned that someone legitimately got hurt and that wasn't supposed to happen? Yeah. Of course, now we're doubly more invested.
Well, the question is now is that what everybody wants to know before we move off Brock Lesnar and Randy Orton is...
Can Chris Jericho beat up Brock Lesnar? Yes.
Yes. are they going to do a round two between Lesnar and Orton? And when is Lesnar going to come back? Because, yes, he probably wanted to do more UFC, but he's suspended. And now, I mean, I don't know what's in his WWE contract, but who knows when he'll show back up to challenge Orton. So I mean, I would like to see more of that because I feel like, again, it was more one-sided, but we need a rematch of that, I think. I think
we talked about this on text after the actual match, but I think what needs to happen is I don't think we need another Orton-Brock match because Orton didn't really seem to be super concerned about, like, getting his win back or getting revenge on it. It was just more like those, you know what, he hit me with everything he had, he left me bleeding, but I'm here the next day talking to you, so it wasn't that big of a deal, you know what I mean? So, like, I think the best thing to go forward is that because Shane got attacked by a Raw wrestler, and then also Stephanie McMahon only fined Brock Lesnar $500 in storyline, which, by the way, that got picked up by CNN. That was a story that ran on CNN.
Which
was
is hilarious.
Brock Lesnar gets fined $500. Obviously Stephanie doesn't care that Brock is a rampaging beast, and Shane does. So I think the logical storyline going forward is Shane throwing everything he's got to take down this beast the next time he shows his face. And you have, you know, Shane's a good storyteller, a good talker. And obviously there's a locker room full of great people over there. Whether you turn AJ Styles face or you throw John Cena at him again, or you, maybe you do, rehabilitate Randy Orton or, you know, whatever. I feel like there's a really good, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 month storyline here where you can just have Shane versus Brock, Shane versus Brock in a match, but like SmackDown versus Brock. And that's a really good way to keep SmackDown on people's radar and also make the most use out of Brock's limited dates so that you're not really tying him up in long-term one-on-one feuds over his absence. So I think that's a really smart way to deal with this until the Royal Rumble or maybe even until WrestleMania.
Yeah. All right, so moving on from that, do y'all want to go straight to Shinsuke and Samoa Joe, or would you rather go to...
I think we're all missing a very important piece of WWE SummerSlam.
Okay.
We found out firsthand that the fans are so mean to Eva Marie that she has to take a 30-day sabbatical to clear her head from how nasty of messages she's gotten because of her lack of ability to get to the ring on time.
That's true.
So I honestly couldn't tell as you were starting there if we were going to make fun of Eva Marie or if we were going to make fun of Colonel Sanders, Dolph Ziggler, outshining actual Dolph Ziggler.
How do you think Dolph Ziggler feels that his match against a chicken was ranked higher on the card than his match for the title?
And was kind of better.
Yeah,
I was more into the match for the chicken.
I was too. But we have to at least pay tribute and acknowledge how good the John Cena AJ Styles match was.
Oh, it was above my expectations, and during a lot of that match, I'm an unrepentant Cena mark. I love him to death, and I know that sometimes he is a very frustrating wrestler because of his final round or final seconds invulnerability problem. The story he tells during the match and how hard he works at his age and at his level of fame. Like, this is a guy that can literally just show up, do three moves, and pin people and be just as over. He goes into these big, big matches, and he lays it out better than probably any face that runs the place wrestler that's ever existed. He's a better wrestler than Hogan ever was. He's a better wrestler than The Rock ever was. On certain days, I would say that he's a better wrestler than Stone Cold ever was. I mean, I'm probably not going to go that far. But, like, for someone that is pretty much the sole reason why a large population of people watch wrestling, he does not have to bust his ass to the level that he does. And he busted his ass during that match. And I'm super happy that he lost clean. I think this was the right place to kind of push someone up, especially because SmackDown is so smart with the way it builds its programs. If you watch Talking Smack the week before, John Cena was a guest, and Daniel Bryan asked him basically point blank, how much longer are you going to be here? Like, you're coming up on 40. Is this what you're going to do until you can't do it anymore? And John Cena said, basically verbatim, that he is actively waiting up and take his responsibilities from him to show up every day, bust their ass, represent the company, put on great matches, entertain people, and do it because they want to do it. And when that day comes, he'll take a back seat. He's happy to do it, but someone has to step up and be as good as he is at this. And that was the week before SummerSlam.
Yeah, you know what? AJ Styles
stepping up and doing all of those things was a good conclusion, or at least the next stepping stone in the story that they set up on Talking Smack. SmackDown has been the last 4 weeks of setting up storylines and paying them off and making it as a place on the card and everyone's feud matters. The match was awesome, but what is equally as awesome is how this is actually going somewhere. So it was absolutely fantastic.
And what, Mike, what do you think about that match?
I thought it was great. I think that, I completely agree. I think the one thing that is a little bit, that I'd say that puts it behind what we're going to get to as far as, match of the weekend is that the stakes to me were not as high as they could have been. I think that what Tom's describing is kind of what they were doing on Talking Smack was great. But if you were watching that video package before the match or just watching SmackDown in the weeks leading up to it, I think that it was a good build. There was certainly, it was an anticipated match, but it wasn't the you know, it was the third or fourth highest match on the card. And, you know, and that does sort of, you know, there's something about a main event that's anticipated and then lives up to the hype or exceeds it that is really, really special. And so this match, you know, while it was excellent and hit all the marks, and I'm so excited to see AJ Styles challenge for the title, you know, I don't think it quite got there for me just because it wasn't positioned that way.
That is the one weird thing that I really didn't like about SummerSlam, and I try not to be super negative on the product anymore. You all know me from back in the day. But one of the things that really was upsetting about it was how weirdly it was structured. Like, the women's title match being on second was such a weird decision. Two matches that were basically non-starters, like the whole Roman Reigns Rusev thing, which literally never started, and then the Brock Orton match, which ended, you know, seemingly quickly with a maybe that wasn't supposed to happen ending. A really strange way to book that card. And, like, why would you put the only legitimate world title you have, why is that, like, in the middle of the card? Why is that, like, why is that not your co-main event? You've got two people that are fighting for a title that actually has a lineage going back to the 70s or earlier versus a title that has a lineage going back to the beginning of that match. You know, like, why weren't these things that are championship matches that should mean something, why weren't they given a more prestigious part or placement on the card? That was the really one thing about SummerSlam that I thought was truly bizarre, was the pacing of it and where they put stuff. Like, that John Cena-AJ Styles match absolutely wore people out after basically half an hour of one of the best matches that either of those two has put on this year. And it was fourth. It was fourth up. There was, like, six more matches left to go.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the big problems with SummerSlam, is that it was, like, WrestleMania. It was 6 hours long.
It was too damn long. Yeah.
Yeah, that's... I do... And, you know, we'll talk about SmackDown a little later, but, like, SmackDown being 2 hours is just a breath of fresh air, and I wish WWE would start saying, hey, these are our prestigious shows, like SummerSlam, WrestleMania, Survivor Series, Royal Rumble, so we are going to make them awesome from a storyline perspective and a match perspective, and we're not just going to make them bigger or longer,
right?
Because it is, especially people, like, I'm sure there was lots of people who went to NXT the night before, which that went half an hour over. Then they're running into 8 hours of wrestling in 2 days. That is a lot for a person to sit through. So it can be. I do think it's a bit of it's a bit of guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
In some cases, which I don't, you know, it is what it is. I doubt it'll change, but I do wish they would keep things a little more brief because it really does matter.
All right, so Mike, before we get off of SummerSlam, I have one question. Are you excited that Charlotte regained the women's championship title from Sasha?
No. I thought having Sasha carry that title for some period of time would have given her some momentum, although I've seen since then that she's taking time off and is perhaps more injured than we initially thought leading up to SummerSlam. So if that's the case, you know, then there's not a whole lot to complain about there. I think Charlotte's excellent, and I think you could do a lot with a series of challengers coming after Charlotte over the next few months and all getting knocked down. She's perfectly capable of holding that title and legitimizing it. But, you know, I'm a Sasha Banks fan. I would have enjoyed to see her carry that belt a little longer.
Yeah, do you feel the same way, Tom? Do you think there's, like, a storyline, again, with Charlotte being the champion?
My immediate reaction to the pin was shock and disbelief and horror. But after that subsided, And this was before even knowing that Sasha needed to take time off for honeymoon and injury and all that stuff. I was super happy with it because I think Sasha, despite being potentially the best wrestler in the entire world, works a lot better in the chase. And Charlotte is such a better champion than a challenger for the championship.
Right.
And I think Sasha deserves a good long run, but I think giving her to it, you know, giving her the championship on the first Monday Night Raw after the split was a huge surprise. And then taking that away from you a month later, only to have her chase it again, is only going to get those fans, me included, more behind her when she returns, more so than getting behind her to keep it. She just works better as an underdog. Not an underdog. She works better in the chase.
Yeah.
She works better when she's not champion, trying to be champion.
Right.
Much like kind of how Bayley will go. And like I said, we'll see what happens. But no, I after my initial, holy crap, they actually pinned Sasha clean, I was like, okay, that's actually a good thing because Sasha is going to be white hot when she comes back, like ripping white hot.
Yeah. All right. I agree. Should we move on to the NXT TakeOver Brooklyn Part 2?
Absolutely.
All right. So, Mike, I know we all got texts from you today, and you couldn't get over yourself with the Nakamura entrance. So I want you to take us through in real time what you were thinking and feeling when you saw Shinsuke come out at NXT TakeOver.
Sure. So, for listeners out there, first things first, you can go on YouTube and you can, if you just search Shinsuke Nakamura theme, there is a version of it where it's an actual live violinist playing Nakamura's theme. I have probably listened to that Nakamura video like the same number of times that the rest of the world has listened to Gangnam Style. Like, it is my absolute favorite thing. And so, you know, TakeOver was great. It hit all the high points. I thought it was paced wonderfully. I loved it. I thought it was really one of the best NXT shows ever, because it had a sense of pace to it that some of the others didn't. And when it got to main event time, I was ready for the main event. And the main event starts, all the lights go out, and a violinist start playing Nakamura's theme song, and the entire arena is pretty stunned, and it's one of the more powerful entrances I can recall seeing, and especially when, you know, the Shinsuke Nakamura comes up in the red block text on the screen behind him, and Nakamura's behind him under the strobe light. It's amazing. I mean, I think that I'll say this. The NXT TakeOver main event could have easily been the main event of WrestleMania, and I would have walked away completely satisfied.
Yes.
The performers, like the build-up was perfect. All the little things were perfect. You know, they got in the ring together, and they immediately kind of started going at each other and had to be separated. They knew each other pretty well, but they still, you know, there were moments in that match where both guys really shine. And I just think it was one of the better told stories, kind of from start to finish, if you go all the way back to just the match being set, that WWE's told in a while.
Yeah, no, I totally agree that the whole match, or the main event with Shinsuke and Samoa Joe, it was, because in real life, Samoa Joe would pretty much kill anybody. And to him dominate Shinsuke for the most part, for the first part of that match, was insanely good. But Shinsuke kept up with him. And then the tide turned. And it was just a good back and forth. And they were both, like, selling each other. And like they were both on the same level as one another, and that's what really brought it home. Tom, NXT TakeOver, talk to me about that final championship match.
I just watched it again before I recorded this podcast because I wanted to, like, get fresh eyes on it. And it's remarkable. It's just a fantastic storytelling piece, because it's hard. It's so recent. I don't want to be like masterpiece, but it is everything I wanted to see out of a title match between two of my favorite wrestlers that are both two of the toughest guys going. There wasn't a ton of like near fall drama, which I liked. Like, it wasn't like the tag match, which I loved. I love the tag match, but that was a very high intensity, almost choreographed match where there was so many near falls and so many almost. This match wasn't laid out that way. It was two, for lack of a better term, hosses just dog piling each other until one of them won, you know? It was exactly what I wanted to see out of that match. It was Joe being a finesse at being a submission machine. You know, his shirt is the Samoan submission machine, but he doesn't always finish matches with the Coquina clutch, and you don't get a sense of how good he is at that. But there's that whole segment where, like, he has Shinsuke in a leg lock, then he moves it over to the STF, then he moves that to the crossface when Shinsuke is getting too close to the ropes. And it's just a quick, fluid, amazing, oh no, this guy is actually really good at this style of wrestling, where Shinsuke doesn't have that. Shinsuke is a striker. So it was a fantastic display for both men. Now, the only question I have for Mike, before we get your brief take on it, Brian, is did everyone in Huntington Beach feel their jaws hurt when Joe got kicked in the face?
I sure did. I sure did. I've been doing the thing where I kind of move my jaw side to side all day, just making sure it's in place. That was a monster kick. There were so many great sequences in that match where it looked rough. It looked decidedly unchoreographed, to yes. your point, Tom. Yep. You know, where it looked like they were both trying to get one over on each other. You know, Nakamura's knee would come up just as Joe was throwing a punch, or they'd kind of roll on a like sort of an MMA style, and Nakamura would go into full guard. And, you know, there were these sequences where they were, you know, I have no doubt that they were carefully laid out in time, but the timing was all spontaneous and was just done really flawlessly. And I think that, you know, both of those guys just blew me away. I mean, I was already big fans of both. You know, obviously have a personal connection to Samoa Joe since we grew up in the same city. I was so impressed by both of them, and just think that, you know, this kind of match was, like we were saying, expectations were high, and this match exceeded them.
There were so many moments where all of the kicks to the head and the face seemed just like so powerful and real, and just it looked like it hurt so bad in that moment when you saw Samoa Joe like check his jaw. You're just like, oh god, it like looked gnarly. Because he did break his jaw, right?
He didn't break it.
I don't know.
I think he dislocated it. I think he tweeted about it the next day, saying it popped out. Got it popped back in the next day, or like an hour after the match, or right after the match. He's still he's not medically cleared to wrestle, because dislocated jaws take a little bit of time to heal, but it shouldn't be too long. But yes, his jaw came out of socket with that first Kinshasa, and you can tell. Like, I wasn't looking for it, like specifically to see how bad he got kicked in the face, but like after he takes that first Kinshasa before the end, you can see him, like, after he kicks out of the pin, he like sticks his fingers in his mouth because his jaw is not closing the way it's supposed to, and he actually calls the ref over and points directly at his mouth just to let him know that, hey, I can't close my mouth, you know? So, like, it is, and obviously, if you notice, the match ends right after that with the second Kinshasa, and it's over. And I'm not sure if that was the planned finish or they kind of went home a little early because there was an actual problem. But the other thing I like about it is that Shinsuke did not pull the second Kinshasa at all. He just straight on needed
yep.
me.
Yeah.
The second time. So, yeah. like, that's how wrestling works. I mean, the show is first, no matter what.
Yes, it is. So, I want to hear both of your takes on Bobby Roode. Is he going to be a big thing? Was it stupid? Was it great? What do you think?
It was glorious.
It was glorious.
Yeah.
No, he was amazing. He was so good. I can't wait to see him. It wasn't my favorite non-Nakamura moment. We'll get to in a minute, but Bobby Roode was right there. I thought he came off as a main eventer. His theme music is just top notch, just absolutely top notch. And I think he's going to be, you know, depending on how long he stays on NXT, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, he ends up being the guy who gets the title after Nakamura has to give it up to get called up.
Yep, he came in immediately as a, like Mike nailed it, is that even though this was a mid-card match, he came in as a main eventer. Like, you absolutely believe that this person belongs at the top of the card, that he's a very important person, that he deserves all the praise that people have been heaping on him. The theme song is everything you could ever want out of a wrestling theme song, except for the fact that he is supposed to be a heel, and this is the most face theme song of all time. So
it's so ridiculous, though, that it can't, like, it still, to me, works as a heel theme song, because I can't, like, I don't want my child to like Bobby Roode, right?
Yeah.
So like, the cynical side of me is like, this is fantastic, but I do think that there's a certain morality in hating Bobby Roode.
Oh, I mean, I think the character himself is obviously super arrogant and is kind of despicable, and, you know, he doesn't cut promos like a face, but the dude appeared on a 20-foot-tall glowing pillar of light. With a theme song that said glorious.
Glorious.
And how do you boo that man? One of my biggest fears about Bobby Roode is that when he really gets deep into heel territory, he's just going to stop using that theme song just to make us hate him even more.
Yeah, I mean, that would be effective, because that's a fine piece of music.
So, no, I mean, I'm all on board with Bobby Roode, with the one exception of the fact that you cannot call a pump handle bomb the glorious bomb when it looks as wussy as that one does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I hope his finish changes. Like, I mean, he can keep the word glorious bomb. Obviously, that's a great name for a finisher, but he needs something with more impact than a, you know, a barely falling over pump handle bomb. It's just not,
right.
It does not have the impact or the prestige that someone with that, you know, caliber of character should have. That's just a bad way to finish matches. So aside from that, I mean, his character's ready to go. Like you said, like, I don't think he'll be next in line to challenge Nakamura, because I think Joe will come back for a rematch, and I think if they're smart, they will, which they are, so I'm pretty sure this is going to happen. I think they'll pull the trigger on a Hideo Itami Nakamura feud. Face and face, not heel face, but amazing when that happens.
I agree.
Well, that gets me to my favorite part of TakeOver.
GTS.
Yeah.
GTS.
So, a few of my favorite things. Hideo Itami. Hideo Itami in loafers with no socks. The GTS as a finish and as like a a concept. And then maybe my favorite of all of those is Austin Aries getting kneed in the face.
By no way, Jose, no way,
so,
Jose.
For all of those things to happen in a 2 minute span was like a fever dream. I was just thrilled beyond belief. I thought it made perfect sense. I think Hideo Itami versus Austin Aries is going to be an awesome feud. I love that Hideo Itami was just like, well, I don't like that you kept beating up this No Way Jose guy who I really have absolutely nothing in common with.
Yep.
And I'm wearing a suit, but I'm going to knee in the face right now. I loved that. And I loved seeing Austin Aries get laid out. Can't wait for that.
That is going to be a great spoiler alert. Those two, Austin Aries and Hideo Itami, actually fought at two of the NXT house shows that I went to last month. That was one of the matchups. So I think they're kind of dry running their eventual feud. And obviously the matches were great because, Jesus Christ, look who's involved with them. But those were great. But yeah, man, like I have to echo that while the GTS is phenomenal and Hideo Itami is phenomenal, that little motherfucker came out in a skinny tie and penny loafers and was the baddest man in the building.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
So, moving on, what do you think of Ember Moon's performance? Do you think she's going to be the one to beat Asuka?
Asuka's going down.
Eventually, that will happen. I think that they are going to keep them separate for as long as possible. I don't think they quite know what to do with Asuka yet. And I think that we're going to see, I'm really, really interested to see who the next challenger for her is, because there's nobody on the NXT roster who can give her any kind of threat at this point.
I mean, it could have been Nia Jax, but she moved up to the main card.
Well, but even so, Nia Jax had a match with her and she lost, you know? I mean,
yeah.
You can't just do the same three people over and over again, but with Bayley being gone, with Nia being gone, even with Carmella and Alexa being gone, like Mike said, there's Peyton Royce and there's
there's Billie Kay. Actually pretty good. But
she's good, but I mean, obviously not to the level that Asuka or Ember Moon is. So you really don't have any strong heel performers in the women's division right now. Obviously, you can build that up, and we'll see where they go with that. But Ember is the lock. But I agree, if you're going to do Ember versus Asuka, that's a WrestleMania weekend takeover main event. That's not anything other than that. So
yeah,
you just gotta spend some time and like maybe you do Peyton Royce and Billie Kay, who are friends in real life, and you do the first ever, but you do a triple threat and you kind of have one of those things where it's like those two girls are teaming up on her. Now they're also going to fight each other when it's proper. But realistically, it's going to be 2-on-1 for most of the match, and maybe that's a good interim play, is just give Asuka two weaker opponents to defend off while Ember Moon just rips up the women's division, gunning for that title.
Yeah. That was... I want to see more Ember Moon, and I want to see more Asuka, I think. I mean, their stories are okay. I just think they need to be more involved. Like, I want to see more of them, because they're both so good.
Asuka is at this point, she's Demon Finn Balor levels of unstoppable. You know,
just like walking around on a Wednesday.
Yeah, no one can touch her. No one. So that's kind of the whole. There is a lack of drama right now in the women's division because you have one competitor who can do it, but she's had one match officially for NXT. So that's not going to happen anytime soon, and everyone else is just dog meat compared to her. I mean, Asuka is like she said, it's just she's completely unstoppable. There's not a single person that I can say. I mean, like even Ember Moon at this stage, like having one match. If Ember Moon went up against Asuka, she'd get her ass kicked by Asuka. So there's no one that can credibly take that belt from her unless they, you know, are secretly bringing in Candice LeRae or bringing in some women's indie talent that we haven't heard about yet. No one can touch her.
Yeah, I agree. It was a good show. It was a good pay-per-view. There's so much to it. But let's talk about that Talking Smack segment. We have to bring up how The Miz is one of the best things in wrestling right now for turning on Daniel Bryan and calling him out. So, Tom, set the stage for us, and you have to tell us if you think it's actually real or if you think it's the bringing back the – it's pronounced kayfabe, right?
Kayfabe. And first of all, Brian, everything is wrestling and wrestling is everything. Nothing is a shoot.
Okay.
Nothing. All right. Or if it is a shoot, it's only to get you worked up. It doesn't really matter.
It kept you up at night. You were thinking about it when you went to bed, and you thought about it when it woke.
Yeah, but good stories do that. So I'll set the stage. So first of all, I am the preeminent pro-Talking Smack voice on this podcast. If you're not watching that show, watch it. It's on the network. Hey, Mike. And
okay, so I can find it on the WWE Network.
For $9.99.
It's basically to set up Talking Smack. If you haven't watched it, it's a show that immediately follows SmackDown, hosted by Renee Young. The guest is always our guest co-host is always Daniel Bryan, who is playing the GM role, and he talks about what happened on the show. But what I like about it is that he comes at it as almost like a performance review every week. He's not just saying, oh my God, did you see it when Carmella turned on Brie Bella? How crazy was that? Like, he's not hyping up his own show. He's actually talking about how that was a weird thing to happen. He didn't expect that from Carmella. You know, like, he's treating it as these things are happening on my show and I want to talk about what just happened because I don't, you know, there's things I'm in control of and things happen that I'm not in control of and I don't know what's really going on. So, and then even on nights where, you know, there was one moment that I remember from a couple weeks ago where Renee Young asked Daniel, so what did you think of tonight's show? And Daniel said, no, I want to ask you that question because I wrote it. I booked it. I put it together. How did I do? Did you like it? What did you think about it? And that was a good, I mean, even though it's kayfabe, that was a great way to solidify that the GM is the creative, you know, decision maker of these shows. He is the one that says, this week this match will take place, and this week we'll do this, and we'll do this. So it's just a wonderful way to get immersed in the world of SmackDown because Daniel Bryan is super fun to listen to, and he's also internet smart. In a certain way, where he will rampantly take a shit all over Raw because it's his partner. So he'll make fun of how stupid their belt looks. He'll make fun of the fact that they created a belt for no reason. He just shits on the competition, which also builds it. But getting to The Miz, this week's episode of Talking Smack ended with The Miz barging onto set because no one is talking about the Intercontinental title. They're only talking about these new tag team titles and the new women's title and all these things that have no history. And The Miz is upset that no one's inviting him on to talk about how important his title is. And Daniel Bryan point blank tells him that he doesn't respect The Miz as a wrestler, which sets The Miz off in a way that I've never seen The Miz set off in my life before.
He called him a coward.
Yeah. So, well, Brian tells The Miz that he wrestles soft. Like, he wrestles
cowardly.
And he wrestles like someone who doesn't want to get hit. He wrestles like someone who doesn't want to get up there and mix it up. He wrestles like a quote-unquote WWE wrestler would back in the day. And before Daniel Bryan gets a point to saying like how the WWE has changed, because now you've got people like Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose and people doing styles that are more independent, you know, like, Miz just cuts him off and basically says, I'm not a coward. I go out there and wrestle every week. And I wrestle the way I wrestle because I don't get injured. I don't take a year off because I wrestle like a freaking moron and hurt my neck. And that's why I'm still wrestling, and that's why I'm champion. Hey, remember when you had this belt, and then you had to give it up because you're stupid? And was like, and just was ripping into him for being an irresponsible, coward wrestler who comes out and says, if I could wrestle, I would. And then he drops the biggest bomb, which is, if you love wrestling so much, quit. Quit WWE and go back to bingo halls and wrestle with all your idiot friends. And Daniel Bryan just walks off the set because he doesn't want to deal with essentially being called out for semi-hypocrisy by a wrestler. And then Miz just looks directly in the camera and just lays the firebomb about how his title is the most important title on the show. He doesn't give a damn about, I think he even says, like, the little kids going for the tag team titles. Like, he just burns everything to the ground around him except for his own title and says, this is the only title that matters. You know, this is better than the world title, and it's mine, and this is my show. And the man shows legitimate emotion that I don't think he's ever really had in a promo before. And it felt like a worked shoot. Like, it felt like something where maybe this didn't go exactly to plan, because, again, Talking Smack is a 30-minute show, and this ended right a little bit after 20 minutes. It ended about 10 minutes early. And it was kind of one of those, like, oh, okay, so that happened. But the Miz's blind fury at being called a coward really woke something in him as a character that I think he desperately needed, which is he's always been kind of undervalued as a performer because he's in movies and he was on the reality TV show, and he's always been more obsessed with, I guess, being famous than being a good wrestler. Even though if you watch his matches this year, he's a fantastic wrestler. He hits moves awesome. He transitions awesome. He knows what he's doing in the ring. He has great ring awareness, a great ring persona. He really is a very, very good wrestler, and he never gets credit for that because he is a supposed to be hated bad guy. So hearing him go off on one of the most beloved wrestlers, and kind of justifiably so, I mean, how would you react if your boss walked up to you during a routine interaction and in front of all of your coworkers basically said that he doesn't like you and wishes you weren't in the position you're in? I would respond the same way the Miz did.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to watch it, Mike?
I did, yeah.
What'd you think?
I thought it was great. I thought the Miz, you know, the Miz did the best version of the Miz he could do. I do feel like since his initial push when they, you know, when he main evented WrestleMania, since then, I've always felt like the Miz is sort of, he's playing a character that's a wrestler. You know, he's like one step removed from his character in a way that the very, very best guys aren't. And that Talking Smack segment to me brought him very close to kind of breaking down that wall. I mean, there's a sense in that once Daniel Bryan walks off and there's a moment where he kind of screams at the cameraman to direct the camera back at him. And you see that at that moment, he kind of, I got the sense he was kind of losing himself in the performance. Like he eventually kind of worked himself into a shoot, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the most exciting part of it for me. I'm really interested to see where it goes because, you know, feuding with the general manager who can't fight you is an odd place to be. But I think that it could go a lot of different ways. I don't see Daniel Bryan as the type of general manager to sort of throw The Miz in unfair situations, but I could very well see Daniel Bryan being the type of guy who puts Miz against, you know, maybe it's against, like, Daniel Bryan complimented Apollo Crews in the Talking Smack segment. Maybe he puts Apollo Crews back in there with The Miz and he says, you know what, Miz? It's best 2 out of 3 falls. And now you know, you're such a great wrestler. All right, here you go. You know, maybe he puts him in fair but challenging situations and we see where it goes from there. I don't know. I'm interested to see where it goes. But I agree. I mean, it certainly getting the text from Tom for how excited he was. I was like, well, I better check this out. I was afraid. I was like, this might get taken off the network if it's as explosive as he says. And it was very good. It was totally worth the 20 minutes or whatever. There's a great Nikki Bella Carmella segment in that episode as well. So
yeah,
have
yeah.
You watch
little
the whole thing.
Appetizer.
You watch the whole thing. Do you like Talking Smack? Is a great showcase little show. Like that was
a great angle.
Show. It was filmed as though it wasn't supposed to happen. Like the camera was swinging around wildly, and everyone was like, "Okay, is it done? Is she gone? Or is she okay? Have you taken like it was? It's presented as." You know, as a spontaneous thing that wasn't scripted to happen, and even the Usos interview, I have never liked Jimmy and Jey Uso as much as I liked them on Talking Smack. They seemed like people; they didn't seem like goofball characters, and that's what I appreciate about that show. Is it really does frame their talent as people doing a job?
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that about it.
I agree.
Yeah. No,
it's good. Yeah, Talking Smack. So we only have a few minutes left. Let's go to some of the questions we got on Twitter.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Okay, here we go. Let me pull some up here. So, here is one from Trey Lawson, at T. Lawson on Twitter. His question is, first Sting, now Finn, Allen's Buckle Bomb be banned?
Should Seth Rollins' Buckle Bomb be banned? We've seen this happen a few times, and it's put wrestlers out for a while. So
sometimes permanently.
Yeah. So you mean Seth Rollins? Yes, he's throwing him into the turntable. But is it the actual other wrestler's fault for landing wrong?
No.
So I think Lance Storm had a quote on this that persuaded me. Obviously, I don't know what you know. I don't know what the safest moves in wrestling are by any means, but I'm pretty sure Lance Storm does. And he said, hey, if you want to work reckless, that's fine if it puts your body at risk. But if you're asking a guy to take a bump like that where he's falling backwards and can't protect himself, then that's on you. And that's the thing is that it really does, you know, those guys fall back and don't have a chance. They have to just take it with their back and hope that Seth throws him perfectly, and it's too high risk for the reward. You know, I think that it'd be a nice trade if he got the curb stomp back, but gave up that one because the curb stomp, as they do it, is pretty safe.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah, I'd be happy seeing it go because there's just no, you know, losing Finn Balor for any period of time is a terrible thing. And not that it's 100% Seth's fault. You know, accidents happen, and, you know, I think Balor probably would have agreed to the spot. But at the same time, I just don't think it's worth it.
Yeah, it's put too many people out.
Yeah, I mean, Sting, granted, Sting's also 56, but, I mean, Sting literally had to retire after that buckle bomb. I mean, it took him out for the rest of his career. And there probably was at least one match left in that guy, maybe two. But, you know, to basically retire a legend because of a move. And Sting has come out and said that it was, quote unquote, his fault that he didn't tuck his chin as fast as he should have to prepare for that move. But again, if you have to do that much thinking on your feet and like I said, you don't know when you're going to hit the thing. You're being thrown you know, you're back to an object. You don't know if it's going to hit your neck. You don't know if it's going to hit your back. You don't know if it's going to hit your shoulder. And, like, watching that Finn thing back, like, yeah, he landed super wrong. Like, he took the brunt of it on his shoulder instead of on his back. But, again, is that Finn's fault? Did he turn in the air? Did Seth aim him wrong? Did he throw him wrong? There's just too many questions to say, okay, you buckle bomb someone. It's a cool-looking move-ish, but it's absolutely not worth losing anyone for any time just to have a buckle bomb. So just turn it into a regular power bomb and be done with it. I do think it, like, if any move should be banned besides a pile driver, which already has been, that is one of the ones where, hey, two of our big stars are out, and like Finn Balor, I think, as champion, was going to really revolutionize and heat up Raw. Like, I think he was going to get a good long run with that belt. I think they were going to have interesting new feuds with him, and it wasn't just going to be him and Rollins forever. Robbed of that because he had to go and throw him against a barrier for really no true effect on the match. I mean, if that spot had never happened, would everyone still remember the match? Of course they would.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, thanks for that question, Trey. But yes, I think it's time to just take that move out of his repertoire. The other question here from Adrian Torres at Yo Adrian Torres is, how far do you think well, actually, he has two questions. So the first question is, how far do you think they'll run with the Heath Slater angle? Meaning, like, how long will they run with it before he gets a contract with one of the brands? So what do you all think?
I think that Heath Slater, I mean, it's going so well for him right now. And as we saw on SmackDown, Rhino and Heath Slater right now. But the whole free agent thing, I mean, he has a shirt that says free agent. It's working for him right now. So it'd be fun to, I mean, the perfect thing for him was when he got into the ring with Brock Lesnar. Like, he had nothing to lose. If he keeps doing that, he's going to be so over with the crowd, even if he gets beat. I think they keep it on for a little while longer.
Yeah, and
because that's his storyline. Because if he gets signed, what's he going to be? He's not going to be a free agent anymore. He's in such a good position right now.
Yeah. I think it ultimately leads to him signing with Shane and SmackDown. But I could see this going on for another couple months just because it's such a good run. You know, it's like, it's entertaining. It's one of the best segments on the show. You might as well just keep it going for a while. But I think that, you know, I could see them doing something where, you know, as a sign of respect for the fans and all that, you know, SmackDown's going to be the more fan-friendly show. I can definitely see that happening. It'd be cool to see, you know, if Jinder Mahal's already back, but it'd be cool to see Heath Slater kind of be able to make demands, right? Now he's an in-demand free agent, and so he could kind of extract certain, you know, perks, and it'd be cool to see him, you know, I don't know, bring back Drew McIntyre or, you know, some kind of perk that he could extract that would be a fun kind of payoff to the angle.
Here's what I think, and I think I just had to Google this to see if it's feasible, but I think that he goes most of the way in the tag tournament, and I think Rhino ends up turning on him because Rhino doesn't give a shit, and they lose the belt because of that. Like, I think if they get beat cleanly, especially by, like, someone like American Alpha, I think American Alpha will be booed a little bit because he's so over. So you have to find someone else to us. But I think, since I think that's what, September 11th, I think, is No Mercy. Is that right, guys? Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
So he goes and does his little stuff, and then he loses the No Mercy stuff. The next week on Raw, I think it's the next, or no, a week from that night on Raw, the Cruiserweights make their debut. And Heath Slater is 216 pounds. He can drop 10 pounds, and I want to see him go for the Cruiserweight title. Like, I want that to be his next challenge. Is, okay, couldn't do tag team, couldn't do this. I'm going to drop a couple pounds and I'm going to throw down with the cruiserweights and be the best cruiserweight. Kind of do the whole Matt Hardy V1 thing back in the day when he competed as a cruiserweight and was just bigger than everybody. I'd really like to see him mix it up on Raw for a couple weeks with a cruiserweight.
That'd be cool.
All right. One more question.
Last question from Adrian Torres. His second one was, who is the next wrestler who gets called up from NXT?
Samoa Joe.
I think it's Samoa Joe, too, because I think they're going to keep Shinsuke there longer than they'll keep Samoa Joe there.
I'm gonna surprise all of you and tell you that it's going to be the perfect 10 Ty Dillinger.
That's a good pick. No belt. It could happen anytime.
Wow. I like that.
So, yeah, man, I mean, this week was just an excellent week for being a wrestling fan. If you're not into wrestling, there's so much for you to jump into. There's so much for you to enjoy. And we didn't even talk about New Japan. We didn't talk about Ring of Honor. We didn't talk about Evolve. We didn't talk about any of that stuff because this was a big WWE week just in general. But if you haven't started with wrestling, there's so many avenues for you to jump into. Lucha Underground's third season starts in 2 weeks. If one thing isn't your speed, don't worry. There's something for everyone in the world of wrestling. So we encourage you to seek some of it out, dip your toes in, because there is a world of delights to be found in this realm. When it's done right, there's absolutely no better storytelling on the planet, because no one else does storytelling like wrestling does.
That's true, and you can find and communicate with us and tell us what you like, what you don't like on Facebook at Wrestling Is Everything Is Wrestling Podcast, or on Twitter at WEWPod.
And also feel free to email us. We are wrestlingiseverythingpodcast@gmail.com. We will 100% respond to your emails with any questions or comments that you have about how sexy our voices sound.
Yes, and stay tuned to next week. Mike Pertil is going to give you the entire dish in his opinion on Randy Orton.
That's right.
So until
voices in his head are coming out.
Yes, it is. So thank you for listening to us, and we'll be back next week.